This presentation is sponsored by Lumina Foundation as part of WFYI's American Graduate Let's Make It Happen initiative, made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Lumina Foundation's goal is to increase the percentage of Americans with high-quality degrees and credentials to 60% by the year 2025. Goal 2025 is focused especially on adults, first-generation college students, low-income students, and students of color.
We're going to go ahead and get started now. Thank you all for being here this evening. This is the fourth of our informational series, and tonight we're going to focus on education finance. I know a lot of times when I mention education finance, you can start to see everybody feel like, oh no, it's another one of those discussions. I can assure you tonight will not be that. We have a tremendous special guest with us tonight in Paul Hill, and have a very distinguished and knowledgeable panel with us as well. Couple housekeeping issues and a couple things I need to get out of the way before we get started. I do want to thank the library again for having us here this evening. I don't see Melanie and Chris tonight. They've run for cover apparently when I start talking, but Melanie and Chris have just been instrumental in making sure that we're have all the accommodations that we need and just make these events all that much better when through their work. Also need to thank all of our tremendous volunteers, and especially Kelly Bentley. Kelly's over there. Without Kelly, these events just simply wouldn't be possible. So Kelly, thank you very much for all your hard work and putting everything together. And there's a lot of work that goes into one of these events, and I have to say that Kelly does a lion's share of it, to say the least. Also want to thank Aisha. Is Aisha here? I think she's still out in the hallway. She is our intern that is sitting at the table and probably still taking names, handing out books, and everything else. Incidentally, if you did not get a copy of Joe Williams' book and would like one, they are free out on the table, so grab one on your way out. There were some copies of the experiment as well. If you would like to have one of those are free as well. I don't think there was that many of them, so they may be gone. There's Aisha. Aisha, thank you so much for all your help. Christina, thank you. These two ladies will be collecting the cards. If you didn't get a card to ask questions, they have them in their hands. Hold up your hand. They'll be glad to give you a card, and you can ask questions later when the panel is started. I also want to thank Miles Mendoza. Miles, if you could wave to everyone. Miles is the head of Education Reform Now. If you look at the sign, that is who is sponsoring these events. So, Miles, thank you very much. You and Kelly, without the two of you, these events certainly wouldn't be possible. So thank you. We'll go ahead and turn to the person that you want to hear from. It is a tremendous pleasure for me. I come out of the education finance world, and I have been following Paul's work ever since I started in the education finance world, and we won't say how many years that goes back. But I'm going to condense Paul's bio tremendously, and if you've ever seen a list of the publications that Paul has done, it's just absolutely amazing. Your publication list is actually a publication in itself in many respects. But Paul is a research professor at the University of Washington. He is the founder and former director of the Center on Reinventing Public Education, which studies alternative governance and finance systems for public K-12 education. He is a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings and Hoover Institutions, and he chaired Brookings' National Working Commission on Choice in K-12 Education. Before joining the University of Washington faculty, Dr. Hill worked for 17 years as a senior social scientist in RAND's Washington office. For most of that time, his research focused on the reform of elementary and secondary education. He conducted studies of site-based management, governance of decentralized school systems, effective high schools, business-led education reforms, and immigrant education. He also contributed to studies on defense research, research and development, and acquisition policy. At RAND, he served as the director of Washington Operations and the director of Education and Human Resources Program. He was also a government employee, worked at the National Institute of Education's Compensatory and Education Study, and also, I believe, was a congressional staff member at one point, too, till you were fired. I'm sure there's a great story behind that. And if you haven't seen, Paul has done some wonderful work on actually the financing of putting digital, more digital and technology-based programming into classrooms. It's just fascinating stuff, too. So without further ado, I give you Paul Hill.
So in order to shake you up, I won't start by talking about finance. I'll get there. But I want to be sure that the finance talk is put in context of the broader reform agenda. And I don't know how it is here, but in Seattle, reform or reformy are kind of nasty words that mean bad people that don't like the public school system. Certainly I think there's a unified sense of purpose and a unified theory that's behind what DFIR stands for and what is really sweeping the country. And finance is a big part of that, and I'll talk more about school finance and especially the idea of what we call backpack funding for kids, that basically all the state and federal and local money follow children to schools. But that's only part of it. And sometimes I think the press and maybe even we think of these elements of reform as being unrelated to one another, and actually they're tightly related. So you have the idea of backpack funding. The second is that schools become real organizations that have control of their money and their hiring and their programs. And third, that then performance measures are made about school outcomes so that schools that can't use their autonomy either have to get better quickly or can be replaced with new schools, and that means there's a search constantly for new providers, new ideas about instruction, and we can talk a little bit about new ways to apply technology to instruction as well as just new ways of organizing people's work. Then new ways of employing people, partly that is new ways of hiring conventional teachers and compensating them for their value to the school. But other innovations about who works in schools and under what circumstances, even to the point, for example, of doing crazy things like hiring people who actually know physics to teach physics, but doing it, you know, hiring university faculty or students part-time. These innovations are all part of the same reform idea. Broadly from that, new sources of talent, not only entrepreneurs to run schools, but people who normally wouldn't be teaching in schools or leading schools who find it rewarding to do so now. And then new use of technology, as I alluded to, for personalization for students and also for dealing with financial shortages. And we could talk about all those if people want to. But to my mind, this is not just a list of elements. It's a list of mutually complementary parts of a whole reform strategy. And the only reason to be for student backpack funding is because it links to school autonomy and accountability and openness to new ideas and new suppliers and so on. So that I just wanted to make sure that we didn't, even though I'm now going to dwell on finance, didn't get stuck in a pigeonhole. but now I want to talk about school finance, the system we have and the one we need. And I did, with some legislative staff and legislators today, talk about my own personal journey, which I will not drag you through, about figuring out how desperately hidden from school leaders and staff information about money is, and how almost nobody in the education system has control of enough money to feel responsible about its use. And I talked about that as a set of discoveries. Everyone was holy cow to me, starting, for example, in learning that the average district-run public school teacher may run a building that costs $2 or $3 million a year to run and has $60,000 in discretionary funding. Everything else is spent above his or her head. Just some facts about the old system, the system that prevails now. We talk about the idea of funding schools and funding students, but that's not really what gets funded. My state happily, yours is not like this. In my state, the only thing that gets funded is teachers. We actually drive money to schools by attaching money to individual teachers. And we could talk a little bit about what that might do to discourage innovation. That's an extreme case. North Carolina is another one. For the most part, what gets funded are not schools or children or even classrooms, but stuff. Buildings, buses, people, administrative structures, so that there are many places there are rules that a school of a given size can have so many administrative staff, and if it gets over that size, it gets another one, plus a librarian, and if you add so many more students to a school, you get another teacher. But all those things come in big lumps, and they cost money, but they don't bring money. Other things that are funded are salary increments, for example, for seniority or for master's degrees or for certifications like national board certification. Big important functions like transportation. There's money in transportation budgets, money in capital budgets for buildings and maintenance. Via federal programs, there's funding for categorical programs, particular students in particular contexts who can't share space with other students and the like. And the reason I'm going through this litany is that basically the way the system is funded is it's funded in its pieces. Nobody, not Arne Duncan, not the state secretary of education, not the school superintendent, not the principal, not the teacher, has any real leverage over how it's spent. It's all kind of done in the most diffuse way. This is a long way from the reform agenda I just talked about, because this is a mechanism, the existing financing system is a mechanism, first of all, for diffusing responsibility. It's impossible for anybody to say, yeah, I made the decisions that led to the school being the way it was, because that's not true for anybody. Secondly, it makes it pretty unreasonable to expect that schools that don't work will be held responsible for it to the point where they might get sanctioned or replaced. I do want to talk a little bit more about how the system got that way, because that may help us figure out how to get it the other direction. I think there are three ways the system got that way. The most important is that the funding system for K-12 has been built up by cycles of advocacy. Over time, the legislature could get convinced that, we really should have a secretary for every principal. So that could get added as a funding item. We really should have some more computers in the classrooms. We have to extend our bus services to families. We have buildings that are falling apart. We need to put more money into their renovation. I mean, going on and on. And then more recently, it would be better if we had smaller class sizes. It'd be better if we hired teachers that had national certificates. And the truth is that every one of those purposes for spending is not crazy. They're all plausible. You can't really say, for example, that other things being equal, really big classes are better than really small ones. You might say that it isn't clear the class size increments of the kind we can pay for make any difference. But that it is the idea that the advocacy only makes a plausible case that this would be a good thing, and that leads to a new funding structure. So in the long run, we ended up with literally hundreds of different sources of funds that come together at the district and school level. I talked in the legislature today. When we started the research about how school districts spend their money, one of the first things we discovered in studying Denver was that at that time, the central office controlled 200,000 separate accounts, and that no one knew where the money was. And in fact, we actually had a series of PowerPoints that we charmingly called the "Oh Shit" PowerPoints, and the purpose was that we would ask the superintendent or the chief financial officer, where do you think you put more money into X or into Y? And we actually had the data by then, and they never got it right. We weren't talking to fools. this was a system that was made inadvertently, but made not to be mastered. So there's this. The big problem is that the system's been built up by advocacy, and then the second that I think we all have to admit is that many legislatures that had the general desire to increase funding for schools nevertheless didn't want to give it to districts in lump sums because they knew it would be captured by collective bargaining. And if they didn't want just to fund a higher salary for teachers, then they would put it into something that was sequestered from salaries. So you see why it happened, but it didn't mean it had good results. And there have been some pretty serious consequences for this. First of all, those of you who've worked in or studied regular district schools know that the schools are quite deeply bound up in what they do. Most of them don't choose their teachers, don't choose their curricula, have very little control over things. And what's interesting is that this one consequence has led to a funny kind of hero story in public education. Our heroes are the people who were buccaneering enough to ignore this and break all the rules and mess with money in ways that were not legitimate but under the rules. We actually created a system that only noncompliance can have good results in. The second is that the system really hides costs. It's very hard if you have 200,000 separate accounts, but they all interact. You know, some part of these 200,000 accounts actually lead to services to schools, but you don't know how they combine, and often in school districts, the human resource, the personnel expenses, are separated entirely from the functional expenses. So you may have personnel attached to professional development or other things, but there's another budget for that operating expense of the program, not the personnel. Very hard to combine those. I said today earlier that as we looked at trying to figure out how much money there was in schools, it turned out that the district budgets were inadvertently terribly misleading because that teachers, senior teachers can teach whatever school they choose to teach in. They tend to cluster in certain schools. That makes their costs really high. That also means that in other schools, much younger teachers cluster. Their costs are low, but in order to not show those inequities, school districts generally report average salaries that hide the fact that there are huge differences in real spending. Basically, the problem is we've created such a complex structure and so many opportunities for shell games, you know, like separating different kinds of costs and so on, that we kind of blinded ourselves. The funny thing is, the only force I can think of that seriously benefits from this system, or thinks it does, is teachers' unions, because of the way the real costs of teacher salaries and stuff are hidden. But I would argue that is an illusion as well, that the working lives of teachers could be so much better if money were more available to use on things that mattered in the classroom, including things to pay the most valuable teachers the most, that the constituencies of teachers unions would be better off than they are. But so that it's one of these situations that doesn't really benefit much of anybody. My center has been working on this for a long time. We've joined with a lot of others in making a proposal about how to rethink school finance. And this proposal is so close to being trivial that I will try to dress it up. But the proposal basically is to fund students. And what dresses it up is this, that if you think, what else could you tie money to in the public school system and not inadvertently stick it in some place that it may not be very useful? And the answer is no place you can think of. If you, for example, even do something that seems pretty obvious to me, which is to say every school should get a principal. Well, actually, if therefore you have a special allocation for a principal, that could block innovation. There are plenty of schools now that are operating 2 and 3 to a principal. So that even what seems like an obvious categorization of funds probably does not probably blocks off opportunities that you need. Certainly, rules that say every school has a given administrative structure, every school of a given size gets a counselor, and so on. There's first of all, there's no evidence at all that this relates to any outcomes. And I think there are a lot of schools that would do very well being administered exactly according to the state formulas, but there are a lot of them that wouldn't. And so why would you make it a mandate? Why would you make it difficult to move the money? Certainly, teacher seniority, which is something very hard to change. Master's pay, no evidence whatever that master's degrees affect teacher performance. A lot of high-performing teachers have master's degrees, and they should get extra money for their performance. But the master's degree is not related. And even class size reductions. Now, it may be that in some cases, when legislators voted for class size reductions, they didn't think it would actually lead to a uniform maximum class size. But in fact, in most places, that's what it's done. And the truth is that, well, first of all, there's no strong connection between increments of less than 100%. Cutting a class size in half might make a difference, but cutting it by a few percentage points doesn't. But it's also clear in very effective schools that class size is a variable that the principal exercises. There are some classes that need a lot of individualization and others that don't. And that can be about the teacher, it can be about the subject, it can be about the kids. And so in some ways, by tying money to class size and therefore by standardizing class size, one of the most important things that a principal has to do, which is to allocate those resources, is taken off the table. I won't rave on a lot further, my own view is that transportation, which is often a hermetically sealed account that can't be touched, and yet some districts would not use as much transportation as they've been given money for. And furthermore, as we see when schools don't get money for transportation, they often spend some of their money on transportation, but they also find a lot of ways to get it done otherwise. That should not be a separate category. And my own preference is that school buildings be owned by independent real estate trusts and rented by schools, and that schools get all the money that now goes into the capital, which would greatly increase their nominal fees, their nominal income. But you want schools to be able to locate in buildings that are right for them. You want them to pay only the rent they want to pay. You even want to create incentives for schools to use their space efficiently, to operate longer. And for example, if there weren't a special funding category for facilities, you could see innovators building hybrid schools where kids spend some time online and some time in the classroom, and serving a lot more kids in a building. I also think that some things we all cherish in our big cities, which is auditoriums and stadiums and the like, people wouldn't be paying for those if they had to take it out of their school budgets. Now, these things have this idea of tying money to the student and not tying it to any other purpose. Has a lot of advantages. I've talked about some of them already. The school can adapt to its circumstances, can decide that some kids need a lot more time, or maybe the whole school needs to be open longer, or maybe you want to trade in people who used to be teachers for a couple of other people who do childcare. I don't know. I think that the point is not to say there is one better way to do it, but there could be a lot of better ways. And of course, another advantage to going to pupil backpack funding is you actually establish a common denominator, so you understand where the costs are, because you actually have a dollar stream and you have a unit to which those dollars are all allocated, which is pupil. And so you can then start to look at the effectiveness of different schools or programs per pupil, or other ways that let you make a much more common comparisons of different ways to use money. And then finally, if you have a common denominator that really tells you where the money is, then you can also link spending to results, which we've never been able to do. I'm just talking about Susanna Loeb, a great professor at Stanford, who I think we agree that there's been no evidence in the research literature that there's any real connection between school levels of spending in schools and school outcomes. But I frankly believe there is one, or there could be, if actually schools could decide how to use their funding effectively, then more money would probably get better outcomes. At least there's a chance. So this idea about how to reform school finance flies in the face of a lot of things we kind of have held sacred about public education. It certainly creates insecurity where, you know, stable bureaucracies, organizations guaranteed funding year to year come under threat. But I think it's essential to open up funding possibilities in the ways I've described in order to get performance and adaptability and innovation and cope with things like financial downturns. Now, to go back to the way I started this talk, I don't think financing is a reform all by itself, the kind of reform I talked about. I would bet on it as, you know, if I could only do one thing, that's what I do. But I don't think it's complete. But the good thing is that financing allows things to happen that can't happen now. For example, that money, if money is attached to children and children move from one school to another, the money moves with them. And that means that if you can offer a better school than the one available, you can get kids to go to it. That means that people who have really good ideas about how to instruct a group of students, especially a group of students that are not being well served, they can have a chance of actually getting their idea funded. Not by going to the foundations or the governor, getting it funded by families that go there. And of course that means that if money can follow students and entrepreneurs can start schools, then you can get diversity of schools, and then you can start to compare different uses of funds to understand which are most productive. Furthermore, if schools have money and can decide how to spend it, then they can decide what kind of teacher they want, what kind of trade-off they want to make between teachers and technology, what kind of staff they want to assemble, how they want to lead them, how they want to invest in professional development, how they want to do problem solving. And that then makes teachers who have very good reputations for academic excellence, being good with students, being cooperative, being team members, lets those people negotiate more salary than they would have otherwise, which then attracts a better quality of people into the profession, or in theory, this is so. Because the money that comes from the taxpayer via the state to the school is brought on the back of the student, then the bureaucracy that now exists that taxes schools to the rate of about 50% of all their money to deliver services of variable value, that bureaucracy would be essentially defunded because the money would go to the schools. Now, in the long run, it's very unlikely that there wouldn't grow up a mature infrastructure of organizations that provide services to schools, everything from accounting and legal services to instructional help to assessment, evaluation. But it's even possible that some of those may grow out of the existing central office, but they would all have to be disciplined by the needs of the school and by the school's need to buy things that make a difference in outcomes instead of things that don't. Glad to talk more about this. I hope that makes sense.
Thank you, Paul. We're going to turn to our panel now. And again, I would remind you that we have Christina and Aisha over here with cards. If you have any questions, we'll take those questions here in a little bit. So just hold your hand up and they will come around and They will come around and make sure that they collect the cards from you. I'm going to turn to our panel, and rather than reading what are tremendous bios, I'm going to have them introduce themselves. I will just say that we are pleased to have on our panel with us tonight Scott Bess, Kariga Rausch, and Ashlyn Nelson. And like I said, I'm going to turn it over to them and have them introduce themselves, but there's a catch. I'm also going to have them address our first question of the evening. And it's a simple question, and that is, what is the biggest challenge on funding or distribution and then the spending side of the equation in our education system today? So just a mild question to start out. Scott, you look like you're ready to jump in, so I'll turn to you. Just a few brief words about yourself and then an answer to the question.
Yeah, that'll be an easy question to answer.
You're welcome.
Good evening, everybody. I'm Scott Bess. I'm the Chief Operating Officer of Goodwill Education Initiatives. We run here in Indianapolis and soon to be in the city of Anderson several schools, Indianapolis Metropolitan High School, which is in its eighth year of operation as a charter school, and then we run the Excel Center, which is a school for students who had dropped out of school and wanted to come back and get a diploma, and we run that at three locations now in Indianapolis, soon to be four, and then one next year in Anderson. So having had that experience, I also say I'm in my fourth term as a school board member at a traditional public suburban rural school. So I've seen both sides of the equation in terms of the charter world and the traditional public. The question of funding really gets into the answer. I would say that there is plenty of money in the system, and I may not be able to go to any more school board association events having said that. But the money in the system is actually pretty plentiful. If you look at what it is as a percent of the state budget, it's certainly significant and probably the majority of it. The question really is how it's distributed and how it's spent at the local level. And I think to Paul's comments that as the money flows in, because it's segmented, it leads to odd behavior. And when you have particularly larger districts who want to have control over large numbers of school, that question of control will always consume higher and higher percentages of the money, and which leads to the spending at the local level, which now where you're at the backpack level with the student, where now you have to make choices because of what's happening at the district levels. I think that's where the discussion has to happen because, again, the totality of the money is there. You know, you can look here in Indianapolis, we have 11 school districts in Indianapolis, plus a bunch of charter schools. And it's you look at that and go, gosh, I wouldn't advocate for saying we only want one district, but how the money is spent across those districts leads to a lot of duplication and effort. And I think that's something that has to get looked at that distribution level, which then affects the spending level.
We'll turn to Kariga.
Woohoo!
Good answer.
First, I am just so thrilled to be with a lot of folks that care about something as deeply as this, to spend their time on a beautiful Wednesday night in Indianapolis in this beautiful building with no windows. So love y'all for being here, and excited to be here. As was indicated, my name is Kariga Rausch. I am the Indianapolis Director of Stand for Children. Been doing that for a while. Before that, I was in the education offices for our last two mayors, our current mayor, Mayor Ballard, and also with Mayor Peterson, and doing education initiatives. Before that, which is really where I cut a lot of my teeth, I worked as a graduate associate and then as a research associate at the Center for Evaluation and Education Policy at Indiana University. And that's really where I learned a ton of stuff about school finance, which you will probably forget a lot of different things that are said tonight, but let me give you two resources that I have found to be extremely helpful in informing both my thinking and a lot of the thinking nationally around school funding and school finance, specifically here in Indiana as well as across the country. Actually, three resources. The first resource would be anything that Paul Hill has written.
Yes.
I mean, he really is very readable, right? And that matters. Second, I would encourage you to go to the Center for Evaluation and Education Policy's website. It's www.keepceep.indiana.org. And they have a special section on school finance where they actually have some pretty good readable papers on how Indiana's school finance system works that I think you'll find really helpful and useful. The third resource that I think is probably the most penetrating that a very good friend and mentor of mine recommended about 2 years ago, Dr. Marguerite Rosa, wrote a book. She used to actually, I think, and I don't know if she still is, but worked back with Paul over at the Center on CERPE. But she wrote a book in 2010 called Educational Economics, Where Do School Funds Go? It is very readable. It's very small. I'm seeing some smiles. Maybe there's some folks in here that have actually read it. But it is just really helpful in really thinking through about how school funding works. To answer the question related to what Dr. Rosa found, that I think I agree very much with Scott, that we have to think about more funding as long as it's allocated strategically, and we have to think about how existing dollars are allocated for outcomes and results. What Dr. Rosa's book and her studies found was that there was more inequity in our system between schools within a district than between districts. Right? Let me say that again, right? So we often in our community have conversations, since we're here in Indianapolis. We've got 11 different school districts, and the way that our school funding model works is we fund districts, with the exception of funding individual charter schools, which actually is an important point that we'll get to later on. Okay, but what her study found in looking at different places around the country was, if you look at how much money schools were actually getting within a district, the deviations were wider than it was between districts. Analogy in Indianapolis is it would be schools like Broad Ripple and Arlington would be getting vastly different amounts of money compared to IPS, compared to Warren or Lawrence or Pike. Does that make sense? I really do encourage you. It's a quick read, but worth your read, because it's really informed my thinking to your question, Larry, about thinking both about reallocation and more funding for things that are actually working, but also thinking about how our resources are allocated. And as somebody who really cares about issues of equity more than anything, Dr. Rosa's work really moved me, because what she illustrated was it was indeed our highest need schools, as Paul has mentioned before, within districts that were getting a ton less money than our more affluent schools, even within districts.
Very good.
Great. Hi, my name is Ashlyn Nelson. I'm an assistant professor at the School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University, and I'm an education economist. And I have for years been reading work coming out of the Center for Reinventing Public Education, and so Paul Hill and Marguerite Rosa have both sort of contributed to 99% of my opinions on why I think school finance is crazy right now, and hopefully less crazy in the future if we take their advice. So in terms of the biggest challenges I think that we're facing as a country and also within the state of Indiana, I think one of the biggest questions that we're always throwing around is, does money matter? To what extent does it matter? How should we be spending our money? Where do we think it's going? Where do we think it's going to matter for student outcomes? And I think underlying, those are all very important questions, but we don't even have basic baseline data to be able to address those questions unless we have some fundamental changes in the way that we collect school finance data and overhaul our accounting system so that we can actually track expenditures within districts. So the way that the Indiana school finance system currently works, and this is the case in most states, is that districts report up to the state how they, you know, how they allocate their funds, and these are recorded on the Form 9 accounting forms, but they don't actually allocate any of these expenditures across school sites. So if you were to take a district's budget from the Form 9 and say, well, how much were they spending on teacher salaries for school X, you wouldn't be able to tell that from any of the budget data that we have at the state level. So all of these sort of questions about the extent to which we think money might matter for student outcomes can't even be done at a school level. And even in districts where they have made some inroads into tracking that type of information, they're often only tracking average teacher salaries across schools, which masks true education expenditures. So I think as a first sane step, we need to take some steps to track things and how they are spent within districts, namely teacher salaries and administrator salaries and benefits, which should account for the vast majority of those expenditures. I think it's not sane to allocate every single expenditure to a kid's backpack. Things like special education and other types of centralized services like transportation might be better off being budgeted for centrally. But I think that's the first sort of step where we need to take this. So without doing any of those first baseline data collection measures, I don't think that we can really make many statements that are plausible about the extent to which we need to increase or decrease the revenues going into our public school systems. We just aren't in a position to make those types of strategic decisions at this point.
I'll pass.
Not allowed. You can if you want.
I think I will. Thank you.
We'll give you that prerogative, but only you on this. The next question I had was, you know, you talked a little bit about, you talked about school autonomy. And this is something that's been visited time and time again. I mean, decentralization plans, site-based management, et cetera. And one of the fallbacks that at least I've always heard is that principals are not prepared to lead a school, at least as the business side of it, as well as the educational side of it. I'll just put that as the question. How do you address that? Do you think they can be? And is there something you can put in place that would allow them to have better ability to do this or greater capacity? Or do you even think it's an issue? And I'll start with you on this one.
So I do think it's an issue. And I think there are conscientious people that are worried about school autonomy for this reason. There are also people that hide behind the problem. It is true that in a big city with a large number of schools and principals, there are probably only a small fraction of the people that are running schools now who've actually managed a budget, done human resources. And so there does need to be a transition. However, the idea that autonomy is a challenge to the current principals is no reason not to move toward it. And there are different ways that localities are doing it now. One is that all the principals who can handle autonomy immediately are given it. There's a staged schedule for certain numbers of schools becoming more autonomous every year for 5 years. Those principals in the schools that are not autonomous in the first year are given training and assistance. They're also given control of budgets where they can hire people to be financial managers and the like if they want to do that. Ultimately, over 5 years, there still remains a number of schools in the district that nobody feels the leadership is ready for autonomy. And then there are two options. One of them is to close those schools and charter them out. Another that's a little more humane is to give the principals one more year to demonstrate that they can adapt to it, and if there is especially with help, if they can adapt to dealing with their budgets, they can keep their schools, but generally half or more of them end up getting chartered out after the final year. But at the same time, the district's understanding that principals turn over at a rate of about 1 in 5 every year, so it goes pretty quickly in some places, that they can bring in a very large number of new principals over time. And they do so by recruiting elsewhere, by recruiting private school principals, recruiting people who run businesses, and supporting them with chief academic officers. So my bottom line is you can't wave the problem away, but you can do a lot of perfectly straightforward organizational change things to make a difference. The last comment I want to make is that when I first started working on this topic, was about the time that Thatcher in England had brought in a whole new education reform and made school heads almost fully autonomous. And there was a tremendous uproar among school heads who said, I'm not prepared for this. This is not what I said I want to do. Why do I have to be the one to say who gets to teach in my school? After all, people will be mad at me. And after 10 years, the same people who documented that first objection went back, and the heads would never give it back. Now, some of the heads have changed. I mean, some of the people that made that objection never changed their mind, and they left the job, and other people came in who were prepared for who understood what the job was from the beginning. But the point is that the management aspects of running a school are not all that taxing on the human mind. People run small businesses all the time. It's true that current principals weren't trained to it. They're high IQ people, and with the motivation, most of them learn to do it.
And I think to take that and piggyback on a little bit, I think that if you have, because again, away from control, right? So if you think of districts in a control model versus having access to smart people to work with, and Paul mentioned a couple, you know, chief academic officer, a financial person, where if you have a principal school leader who needs help in those areas, she has access to those where you know that person is available, that resource is available. Some may need it, some may not. I think if you look at that as a service offering rather than a control piece where, you know, you have somebody today, in today's districts, you have financial people who control the spending, you have academic people who control the curriculum, and I think that's giving that autonomy to the school leader with access to those smart people when they need them. Now that allows that school leader to develop as they need to, if they need to, but also then to have those resources and access to people who they couldn't otherwise afford just on their own. I think that, as you look across, again, particularly in a city like Indianapolis with the size and scope that we've got, having that available versus, again, more of that tightly controlled changes the dynamics of what's going on and creates that autonomy for the school leader without just throwing it into utter chaos.
Comment about that, yes. Totally consistent with what you said, which is that no organization builds capacities it doesn't need. Why would you do it? So you've got a system where that capacity was never needed, and the fact that it is therefore not present is no sign that it can't be. And so you create the circumstances where it's needed and rewarded. You do have to be smart about allocating it and supporting people and urging some to leave, but most places I've seen, Hartford is a very interesting example. They don't have access to chartering very well. They can only do a little bit of chartering. They've had to turn their principals toward autonomy, and they're about 85% successful.
We'll move on to the next question. If funding should follow students, allowing schools, even new schools, to be financed in a market competition format, is there a minimum size that you feel is viable? Not a flat dollar amount, but in an ideal relationship between students, staff, facilities. In other words, how small is too small? We stumped the panel.
You talking about the size of school?
Yeah. Relative to the relationship between students, staff, and facilities is what the question asks.
Well, I'll take a stab and you guys can jump in. I think it depends on the school, right? So you can run a, for example, a storefront school that's got 2 or 3 teachers and, you know, 50, 60 students, and you can do that, you know, very effectively if that's the model of what it does. Now, if you want to start scaling up, then obviously you need more facility and you need more stuff and you need more things around it. But I think that you also have to look a little bit about the definition of what school is. And there's lots and lots of models that work and lots of things that can happen. You just have to be willing to accept that, you know, if you drive down there's a strip mall there and there's this, 10,000 square foot, what used to be a store is now a school. That carries with it a different funding level need than something that's going to serve, 500 or 600 or 1,000 or 2,000 students.
Any others?
So I think it has to be more than one. The reason I say that is that one is essentially, if you could fund one student and they could declare that to be a school, then it's actually a voucher to be used for whatever purpose the parents put it to, or homeschool. Yeah, homeschool, that's one. In public policy, to take that step and take away public oversight of any kind, I think is a big step. And I've been writing about this. I think that you can get a lot of imaginative technology applications and individualization in schools that have charters and operate as brokers of online services. But I'm really not ready myself to go to the point of saying, at the limit, a kid can take it, the parents can take the money and do what they want with it. But it, a very small group of parents could take money and pay a few teachers to buy things online, as few as 5 or 6.
Any others?
No, we'll move to the next question. This is somewhat related. Are there any school systems that have initiated student-based funding for a sufficient period of time where they've measured student performance outcomes? If so, how has the student-based funding affected student performance? I see a pattern emerging here.
So. If we were in a circle, it would look really funny. there are a few districts that have done real student-based funding for a while. New York is probably the one that's done it the longest time. You really do see tremendous patterns of difference in the way money is used and even who's hired in schools. Over the 8-year period of student-based funding, there's a study about how many teachers are employed in the district and in individual schools who are way low on SATs and other qualifications, and those numbers have declined dramatically, including, and maybe most interestingly, in the schools serving the poorest kids. So that there has been a greater focus better teachers, actually teachers being paid more, more use of technology, and there is evidence that the New York City school district average student achievement is increasing. Now, I'm talking to some people that actually do causal modeling, and they'll kill me if I don't make it clear that these are statements in logical, reasonable, but unproven juxtaposition. Did student-based funding cause the change in the hiring of teachers? Well, it didn't stop it. It made it possible. But did it cause it? I don't know. And did that cause the outcomes? I don't know. It's too soon. Do you have any?
So I came to Indiana from California, where I worked with Oakland Unified School District and San Francisco Unified School District, both of which had implemented various flavors of weighted student funding formulas and had begun tracking a certain percent of the dollars following students in these different schools. And they had developed these weighted student formulas that allocated more money to schools on a per pupil basis based on the student characteristics in that school. What I think was really interesting, and I always teach this as an example of what happens in policy when you make decisions when you don't know what your baseline is. What happened in San Francisco is that when they made the decision that they needed to give more money to kids in poverty, more money to kids with certain types of characteristics, And they created this weighted formula to allocate the dollars that way. The way that the dollars ended up flowing was actually counter to what they intended, because it turned out that beforehand, the implicit weights that they had already been giving to those schools was actually higher for those student characteristics. So it actually ended up taking money away from some of the students that they intended to allocate additional funding. So it's kind of an interesting case study of maybe transparency hurting maybe how you wanted to allocate those funds across students to begin with. To my knowledge, San Francisco and Oakland, neither district, as far as I know, has pursued any sort of evaluation that later links the distribution of those funds to student outcomes.
Are they continuing to use that system, or?
I think so. I mean, the problem with Oakland is that they're still using average teacher salaries, so you just really can't tell much from the data because they're just using average. San Francisco remarkably decided to use actual teacher salaries in their weighted student formula, but I don't think, and I can't remember, I feel like there may have been some political issue for them intentionally not wanting to link the dollars to student achievement outcomes, but yeah.
So it's really important to say that, I've tried to make the point early on, that financial reform is an element of reform, it's not the whole thing. And right. And if a district is doing weighted pupil funding and putting more money into the schools than were there before because it's decreasing its central office spending, so it's raising all that and creating a lot more flexibility and using performance-based oversight and closing their worst schools and bringing new providers, you get the kinds of things you see in New Orleans and Baltimore. You see the boat starting to float. Again, not clear exactly what the cause and effect is yet, but my city, Seattle, had student-based funding for a long time until they gave it up. It didn't make any difference either way because they didn't do anything else.
So let me try to take a little different tact with answering that question. Okay, so let's assume that those of us in the room, since we are here on this Wednesday evening for a riveting school finance panel, are probably, you know perhaps a little bit more, at least interested in this issue. How many folks here, let's just confine it to Indianapolis, know if our school districts fund based on a student-based model, or even how resources are allocated from the district office to individual schools? How many of you have a real clear picture of how that works? We saw one hand go up, right? Or two hands. Well, you don't count because you're a school board member. Right? Okay. Isn't that
doesn't make it automatic, by the way.
No
Scott
comment.
Can probably tell you.
Yeah, no comment. Right? So isn't that part of the problem, right, in and of itself, that we don't know how funding is allocated to our schools? Right? So there's a transparency issue there. There's also an advocacy and awareness issue there. When it's not clear to the general public, which it, you know, school finance can be complicated, but it shouldn't be as complicated that we don't know how much money is being spent per kid at each school, right? That shouldn't be a complicated understanding to know how that process works. The fact that we don't know is a problem in and of itself, don't you think?
That leads to a good question to follow that up. What steps or perhaps policies do you think can or should be taken to help people make more sense out of how money is distributed and spent in our education system to create that greater transparency that you referred to, Kariga? They're looking at you like you should tackle it.
So I think there is, and one of the things that we are trying to do as a part of Stanford Children is creating an advocacy base by which some of the highest leverage things that we need to do for kids become more transparent. And this is one of those areas that are on our radar screen to really provide as context. I'll tell you some of the districts that we've engaged here, at least here in Indianapolis. It's been extraordinarily challenging to even get them to get to a place where they can explain to kind of everyday folks how the system works. So because we know we have other questions, I think the very short answer is it's something that is very possible. You look at some districts across the country. I mean, we looked a little bit about what Denver Public Schools are doing and some others that are actually doing a really good job of explaining to folks, right, here's exactly how we budget. Here's exactly how much money is getting into individual schools. Here's how much is stopping at our central office. We don't have that kind of infrastructure right now in this city. If you're interested in learning more about getting involved and figuring out how to do that, please see me afterwards. We'd love to engage you in that process.
So one thing that I think that we could take as a first step, again, I really think that just the tracking of actual expenditures within districts is an important first step that we can take, and it's a feasible first step. So currently, the vast majority of Indiana school corporations use school budgeting software provided by a company called CompuTroll. CompuTroll provides within their software system an individual site code that would allow district superintendents to actually just sort of roll down all of their expenditures across sites. And if you ask most schools, corporation superintendents, you know, how much do you spend on salaries in one particular school versus another, they can tell you that. They just don't have to report it to the state, which is why they don't. And so if we actually just said, hey, you already use this system, it already has a site code, let's just align the site code with this line item expenditure and require that to be reported to the state, then people like me could come in and say, oh, wow, look at all this great data, instead of going individually to each school corporation and asking them individually for data. It could be available on an aggregated measure across school corporations in the state, and then we could begin to do some preliminary analyses linking school expenditures at the site level to academic achievement outcomes.
Professor Nelson makes a really good point. The interesting part in conversations we've had with superintendents has been how the accuracy of coding at the site level versus at a centralized district level. It's been kind of really interesting to understand how there are different districts code those things in different ways. So in addition, I think it's a wonderful point, some consistency in how folks are coded in those kind of systems would also be important.
Yeah, I should add. And also we should like audit these things because it is 60% of state expenditures. And it is insane that we do not audit these.
So just a little gloss on that as well. If there's a pressure for school districts to show that they have very small central offices, suddenly they shrink dramatically. And that's accomplished by Hollywood accounting. You just kind of decide that money that really is in the central office gets allocated to schools. And so the school budget goes up, the central office goes down. There really is a need for a common accounting standard here. But the good standard is if the resource is not under the control of the principal, it's not in the school. Last thing I'll say, the Dread Marguerite Rosa is going to do a national training program on this for CFOs.
Kind of segue on that. Question is asked, what are your thoughts on the Mind Trust plan for IPS reform, and specifically the financial aspect of it that calls for essentially decreasing the central administration, taking the money that would be saved by doing that and funding a preschool early education program? I throw it out there for anyone.
I'll start. I think that there's no better way to take the money from there and spend it than on early education. I mean, early childhood education. I mean, study after study after study shows the investment there pays off down the road and pays off many times over. Again, I come back to the theme of control versus service. And you know, we have today, in our particular city, a district that really focuses on running a school controlled really from the top down. And that's going to continue to suck up an enormous amount of resource. And there's no way not to when you have that many students. And I think that the idea that you can reallocate and you can look at giving autonomy to schools and you can get better school leaders and keep people in place and give autonomy to that principal and the school leader to hire the people that they want to have and then keep them, right? That's one of the issues we face in the city today. And I heard someone say it tonight was that a great program at a school that's shown results everywhere else is struggling at that school because the personnel keep getting shifted by the district.
Well, that's crazy. And so I think that the idea that you can decrease the amount of control, the curricular control, the, you know, the everything else that you're trying to do, turn it into more of a service-oriented piece, does free up that money. And there is no, again, there is no better way to spend it than on early childhood.
So I would answer that question in a couple of different ways. One, I think that there are a ton of really powerful ideas in the Opportunity Schools Plan that the Mind Trust has put forward. And I think they're grounded in a reality of what we're hearing from a lot of parents and teachers across our city. So it's, I think, crazy and disheartening when you're in a school listening to teachers, especially teachers that are doing exceptional work, and they say, well, we think we've built a really good team of folks here, but I'm not sure how many are going to be here next year because the district may decide they need to go someplace else. Right, that just something about that with teaching being such a team-oriented kind of profession, and the education of our kids being necessary to have lots of people, good people working together to do that work, it doesn't make sense to me that that most important element is something that is decided void of the input of principals and teachers that are actually working together. Right, so this idea of autonomy in and of itself isn't a silver bullet, but I think it has a lot of credence in that when you've got a great team of people that are working really well together, you got to do everything you can to make sure that team stays together and does work really well. The second thing that I would say is that for some of our both seasoned principals and teachers, as well as those coming new into the profession, talent is the most important element of making sure our schools succeed in the way that our kids need them to succeed. And we have heard from a whole lot of people that they want to be in control of how their schools work for kids, hold them accountable for outcomes and results, but give us the authority and the flexibility to figure out what it's going to take, right? It's a talent attraction strategy for the kind of principals and teachers that our kids need. So even if we don't think that autonomy, you know, in of itself is a good idea, it's an idea worth exploring because indeed it has attracted a ton of talent to our city. Now, I'm sure there are varied opinions about our public charter sector in Indianapolis. I tend to be one that thinks that we have a whole lot more good charters than we do ones that aren't working very well for kids. And I obviously have selfish ambitions as a part of overseeing that sector. I'm sitting next to somebody who is operating a school that is really doing some transformational work for kids and families. You look at the ability of many of our public charter schools to attract amazing talent at the teacher, school leader, and even board level that wouldn't have gotten involved in public education without that kind of those kind of freedoms and autonomies, right? We need to be doing everything we can to figure out what's it going to take to get more great people with our kids and keeping those folks. Last thing I'll say is... just echoing what Scott said, early childhood education is quality. Early childhood education is critically important. Underscored the word quality, because an unfortunate truth in our community is that we have a lot of early childhood centers in our community that are not doing a good job of making sure kids are ready for what's next. So I am one who is a fan of expanding our early childhood system. Everybody has access. But making sure they have access to a quality system also is more important. And wouldn't it be great if IPS took a lead in figuring out how to do that with existing resources, right? Remember, for a long period of time, IPS was a leader in funding full-day kindergarten before the state funded full-day kindergarten, because they said this is critically important for our kids to be successful, right? Wouldn't it be interesting if the next evolution, now that the state is almost funding full-day kindergarten, right, to be able to fund early childhood education.
I'll make one comment, an outsider's comment about the Indianapolis plan. This will probably not give you a lot of thrills, but your plan, which is still floating around looking for traction in Indianapolis, has been adopted almost wholesale in Cleveland, which was a city that was in desperate straits and very much in need of a reform strategy, had a mayor who got radicalized by some things. And as far as I know, it was almost a search and replace Indianapolis for Cleveland. And this isn't just the adoption of a document. I mean, they actually are doing it. And I wouldn't be surprised that your plan won't be picked up in a lot of other districts as well, because it's extremely well developed. One only hopes that it gets the traction it needs here.
We're going to make you put your political hats on a little bit here for a couple of questions. all excited about this. When vouchers, which we have here in Indiana, fund private schools, yet require public accountability and various other requirements, such as religious opt-outs, do you envision, and it specifically ask about, a Republican revolt against vouchers? In other words, I think the question is asking, when we put accountability in place for schools that are receiving, and maybe it becomes a all-encompassing question, schools that are held accountable for results based on receiving public dollars, does it start to turn the momentum against vouchers? Who would like to tackle that one?
In general, there's very mixed evidence about the extent to which vouchers help student achievement outcomes. I'm not sure whether that will help or hurt any sort of accountability-based measures and tracking of subsequent student outcomes for kids getting these vouchers. I don't know that that will show anything, and I don't know that we necessarily care whether that actually shows anything in terms of student achievement. So it seems like the tide is now turning to this concept of just promoting the idea of allocative efficiency, which is just ensuring that kids getting these vouchers are just well matched with their schools. And so it seems like politicians who are in favor of voucher programs, for example, even if they didn't see higher student achievement gains for the students in the choice scholarship programs, would still turn around and say, but parents are more satisfied. We value choice for choice's sake. There's a better match between these kids and their schools, and maybe start looking at more at multiple measures of student outcomes to assess whether or not vouchers are effective. Things like, you know, are these kids participating in more extracurricular activities? Are they less likely to be delinquent, suspended, have fewer days of absenteeism? Are they more likely to take AP classes and pass them? Things like that.
Others?
Interesting that in DC, they have the DC Opportunity Scholarship Program, and one of the conditions of the program going to the Catholic schools was the Archbishop agree to testing of kids in the voucher program in the Catholic schools. He did agree to it, and the Republicans have been entirely for that ever since. So one would think that Republicans would rather have that that provision in a voucher program than not have it. And what it is interesting that questions of the kind that we just talked about, looking for evidence other than test scores, which don't turn out very well. And there may be some in the DC schools, especially on persistence and college going. But you know, it's worth knowing, and it's certainly worth people insisting that if public fund is going to go there, there must be some public benefit to it, even if it's only information.
This is now Fordham. The Fordham Institute's line is, oh, maybe things didn't happen in Cleveland like we hoped that they would, but. Maybe some people had some outcomes that were not academically achievement-oriented that mattered for them.
So if I could answer really
sure.
quickly, because it's important to distinguish Indiana's program from a lot of other places around the country, in that, as both of my fellow panelists have indicated, the evidence on vouchers in terms of achievement is mixed, right? There are some studies that indicate it's worked really well in some places. There are others that have shown, you know, no gains or other things, but that beside the point. I think the original question was, you know, about, you know, the degree to which accountability is a part of the system. And I think what's been interesting about Indiana is that there has been an embrace by everybody that accountability needs to be a part of every system, right? Which is why in Indiana's scholarship/voucher program, if you are a school that receives students that receive that state funding, every student in your school has to take ISTEP. And in order for you to continue to then receive those students, to receive voucher receiving students, you have to have a certain threshold of achievement. Otherwise, you will no longer be qualified to continue to accept students. So it's been interesting in Indiana that there has been a general acceptance on both sides of the aisle that accountability has to be a part of any system of publicly funded opportunities for kids.
One snag in the current legislation that is my beef as a researcher is that the way that the legislation is currently written is that the choice scholarship receiving schools don't have to report any data beyond what is absolutely necessary to administer the program itself. And so to the extent that these choice scholarship schools don't centrally report to the DOE data on things like student demographics or anything else, it's really hard for researchers to then go back and actually effectively evaluate the effects of a voucher program, because we don't have the same type of student level data for kids in the choice scholarship schools that we do in the public schools. So that's something that I'd like to see revised in the future.
Well, we have your political hat on. This is along that same lines. I believe Paul mentioned that we very much base funding around programs. And in the political world, and Representative Sullivan is still here and probably could speak to this, how do you get away from program-based approach to funding when every program has its own constituency built up around it?
I can tell you a daunting story. When I first moved to Washington State, there was a standards-based reform law that included deregulation. And the idea was they were going to get rid of regulations and programs that were not demonstrably necessary for health, safety, and civil rights. And so I attended the first meeting of the legislative committee that was to make the cuts in the programs, and they had the state code in front of them, and they opened the state code, and they read the first provision. And they said, anybody here like that provision? And, yeah, I do. So that was in. And before a few hours were over, it was clear they were in a complete fool's errand. They would never do any regulation, deregulation. And it's clear that no one will give it up readily. But I don't think it can be bargained out with these individual stakeholders. It really has to be sold to the citizens as a better way to benefit students. It will be hot.
So far, an intriguing question. They've all been intriguing questions, by the way. So far, all the questions and responses have assumed that the structures and kinds, and that's emphasized, kinds of learning outcomes and operations are as they should be. What if we first identified what the purpose of education really should be, what the learning outcomes, kind, type, and quality, are that we need for a full life in the 21st century, then identify better ways to achieve those results, and then decide how to fund it?
Yes, yes, and yes.
We'll throw in how to make it a little more interesting.
I'd be a little contrarian about that.
Go ahead.
I'm actually strongly believe in the premise of the question, you know, that the deeper outcomes are really important and that ultimately, kids have got to be more capable in 20 years than they are now in order to survive, and so we need to be pressing for deeper understanding and more exercise of high-level conceptual skills and so on. I believe all that. But there's no evidence that those skills are not in a hierarchy that starts with reading. In fact, that we've done some work on one element of this, which is kind of public regardingness and belief in the First Amendment and tolerance. And those attitudes, if you look at them in schools, are powerfully correlated to the effectiveness of schools at getting kids to read complicated materials. And in fact, they're probably the same skills, you know, in terms of understanding things in broad context. And I say all this because it is very unlikely that we will ever find that the schools that do all the things we aspire to will not also be best at the things we can now measure. And I think the way to get to the better schools is not to mess around with a long dispute about philosophy and dealing with people's alternative futures. Who the hell knows what the economy is going to look like in 20 years? And get started on continuous improvement processes that open schools to innovation, demonstrate higher performance. And it is true we need to get from basic reading to deep reading to imaginative use of information to use of imagination to create. And all that stuff is true. But if we dispute about all that while we leave the fact that the very large numbers of kids are by the fourth grade already doomed to not being full participants in the economy, that's deeply irresponsible.
Paul Hill, ladies and gentlemen.
Sorry.
No. I have two more questions if everybody will allow for them, and then we will have covered at least all the questions I've gotten from the audience. If we stipulate that teachers should be paid based on their value, do we have sophisticated enough models and reliable data to determine that value? And if no, is it appropriate to push or advocate a policy for which there is no fair or accurate estimation tools existing?
I mean, I'll start as a practitioner, right? So this is a lot of things have changed from back when I first started in education, which wasn't quite a one-room schoolhouse, but I could see it from where I stood. The way that we're defining teaching today, and if you agree or disagree with things like the RISE model of teacher evaluations and TAP system for teacher evaluations, for the first time, and I will tell you, we implemented in our buildings this year, for the first time implemented those little more standardized rubrics, so definitions of what good teaching is. And the most important piece of that actually was really rigorous training for all of our principals and assistant principals and so forth on how to recognize it so that they were consistent with one another, right? So that was before you kind of assume that administrators, by virtue of being an administrator, know how to evaluate teaching, and the fact is they have no idea. So that really rigorous training, the consistency of it, and a commonly understood, right? So all the teachers knew what it was, all the administrators knew what it was, and for the first time we were able to go into classrooms and have consistency with different raters looking at somebody going, you're really struggling in this area, or gosh, you're great in this area, and then professional development time to work and assist and support. And so when it comes to, when I look at the end of the year now, I would say we have a much clearer picture. Is it perfect? No. I mean, there's a lot of room to go, but we have a much clearer picture of who our best teachers are. And what's been interesting now as we've hit the end of the year is looking at our compensation system related to that, and now you see some ahas, because you've got some great teachers, and you go, wow, they're not paid nearly enough. And then you have some other people who, because they'd been around for a while and because they had a master's degree and because they had all this other stuff, who were paid up here, and look at the classroom results going, gosh, that just isn't there. And it's not just one person evaluating them one time. This is multiple people evaluating multiple times, and it's consistent. And it's been consistent throughout the year, so it hasn't improved. That's led to some other discussion. So I think when you look at, you can't simply just say we're going to evaluate teachers based on student performance only. There's lots and lots of debates around that. But if you look at that combination with a really rigorously understood system, and again, there's different systems, and some are great, but as long as it's commonly understood and everybody gets it, now you have something to base that on, and you can get into the idea we're going to bring that into the financial piece of it. Because honestly, looking at our great teachers, I could foresee a day where we have more highly paid teachers, but fewer total teachers. You know, because financially, that's how you have to do it. But when I ask my principals, would you rather have a great teacher with 30 students or two really average, mediocre teachers, as defined by what we've looked at here, with 15 students apiece? And the answer is always, give me the great one with 30. We'll run with that.
And if that teacher now is making a lot of money versus a couple of them making less, they would do that in a heartbeat. So, and I think you'd find the same is true probably across most places.
Others?
I think one of the issues that I have with linking teacher compensation to these value-added or growth models is that growth measurement is highly susceptible to the model specification used as well as the assessment instrument. And even within individual teachers, their average student outcomes can vary substantially from year over year, depending on which students they take in their classroom or a variety of different factors. So there have been a number of studies documenting how unstable these measures are. One of the splashier examples, I don't know if you all remember the sort of huge LA Times article, I guess it maybe 2 years ago that came out, that ranked LA Unified teachers based on their value-added performance of their students. And then, you know, subsequent to that big controversy, some other folks came out, reanalyzed the data just using a different model specification and came out with entirely different estimates of teacher efficacy. There are other studies in the economics literature showing that, you know, a huge percent of teachers ranked in the top, you know, 25% of the value-added learning gain distribution actually fall into the bottom 25% in a subsequent year. And we don't know why these estimates bounce around so much. It could be because, you know, oh, you're good, therefore the principal makes some decision to slot some more problem kids into your classroom and that messes things up. There are any number of different dynamics that could be affecting this. And Doug Harris is actually working on sort of getting more precise measurements by modeling the actual selection of students into the classroom so that econometrically we can better control for those different factors that could be accounting for that much variation in teachers' value-added estimates year over year. That said, even though it's a tale of measurement error to a huge extent, I think they're useful for sort of calling out which teachers are consistently terrible and consistently great. And I'm still kind of bearish on tying teacher compensation to these measures just in general. I don't think that it should be used as the sole measure by any means, but not that I think even Michelle Rhee would say, you know, 25% of teachers' compensation should be based on that, not 100 or something.
I have to just say I totally agree with that. And these are potentially valuable measures even if they're flawed, if they become part of management decision making. That is, if the people responsible to get the good outcomes in the school want to know what the patterns of student achievement are within their school and what the patterns of value added are, it's very well worth their knowing that. Now, many times they're going to have ready answers, like I asked her to take on the class that nobody else had succeeded with, and she had trouble. So, you know, the interesting thing is if it's used close to the school or in the school, this can be a somewhat valuable addition to the information that is already available there. But many of the decisions in the school are made by seeing whether the kids who were with a given teacher are ready to do the next year's work when they arrive. This is not, you know, it takes intelligence but not rocket science. And I think it's very good to have those measures available, but I personally I don't approve of publishing the newspaper because they're subject to so many interpretations. And frankly, I think the idea of central district or state use of those numbers to allocate salaries and rewards is the most counter-reform action you can imagine. You know, if you think about a system that's based on school-level autonomy and entrepreneurship, it goes the other way.
Because so Stand for Children was a part of gathering teachers to advocate on behalf of what's now Senate Enrolled Act 1 in the 2011 General Assembly, which is our principal and teacher evaluation system. And the good news is that our state law requires multiple indicators of effectiveness for a teacher. And there's a bit of misconception out there, not only that law, but a lot of misunderstanding that indeed it is a requirement that only either growth scores or other kind of test scores are the only measure of teacher effectiveness. That's just not true. Our state law actually does require, right, a lot of different indicators of effectiveness, and there is a ton of local flexibility in how those indicators are defined. The way that Scott just described the work that they did is the right way of doing it, right? You get your faculty and staff together to talk about what is effective teaching, right? Come up with some common understanding of what that is. Use a number of indicators. And then, yes, evaluate, change compensation systems in a way that makes sense, that can make sure kids have the best teachers. What can't happen, though, is we say, we don't exactly have the perfect method for evaluating how folks are doing, so let's just not do it, right? Because kids need great teachers. And the truth is, I'm echoing Jeffrey Canada, who has said over and over again, when you see an amazing teacher at work, you are watching a masterpiece. And the truth is, if you, whether it's via test scores, whether it's through professional observations, or any other kind of method, right, when you go into an amazing teacher's classroom, you know it. You can see it. And professionally trained teachers, like some of the great ones we have here, know what amazing teaching looks like and what amazing teaching is. There is a small percentage of teachers we have that are truly masters at their craft. Truly masters at their craft. We have a larger percentage of teachers that are getting better. We need to do everything we can to support them to become great. But it is also true, and this is unpopular to say, but I'll say it anyway, that we have a small percentage of teachers that need to find something else to do because they are not doing great for children. And we have to have helpful systems in the way that Scott has described that allows us to reward and value our masters, to grow our teachers that are getting to that place of mastery, and to find other things for teachers who persistently are not great for kids to do something else.
I think another concern with an over-reliance on these sort of objective measures like value-added learning gains is the issue of goal displacement. And this is something that's very obvious to people working on the ground in schools and maybe perhaps less obvious sometimes to policymakers. Richard Rothstein at the Economic Policy Institute has written extensively on the issue of goal displacement, which is just that when we over-rely on certain types of measures for performance evaluation, that that it often displaces the goals that we have. So the classic example that he gives is when hospitals in London were being assessed on the extent to which they had people wait in the waiting room of emergency rooms, and their hospital grading was based on that. They just decided that, okay, well, I'm going to have lower wait times in the emergency room by keeping people out on the curb in ambulances for longer periods of time. And this obviously had adverse health effects for the people involved in this situation. And you can apply this this type of goal displacement situation, an example, to education. You don't want to create a system where teachers are afraid to take risks by serving difficult students, difficult to educate students, or students with special needs, or underserved students, because they don't want to have their value-added measures disrupted and have that affect their compensation.
Okay. Last question, and it's actually several questions in one. Why do we split up and wall off pots of money in the first place? Dr. Hill said it was to avoid new funding being bargainable. Are there other reasons? Would be number one. And should we be breaking down these barriers and allocating lump sum dollars? What should we guard against with lump sum funding? Three parts. Tackle all or parts
so
of it.
I'll take the easy one. there are a lot of reasons we have money in different pots, and we talked about some of them. Some of them are legislators' initiatives. It's nice to have your name in a bill. It's nice to have the, you know, the Joe Blow professional development program. I don't know how important that is in the states, but it's fundamental in Congress that the reason we have so many categorical programs is to make sure that everybody owns one. It doesn't have a lot to do with productivity. I'll think about the last part. I haven't got much to say.
Any others? Do you want me to read it again?
You can say, don't be California. I think California is the worst possible example of categorical funding gone awry. California, at one point, Alice Waters, who is the head chef at Chez Panisse, this famous Oakland or Berkeley restaurant got in Arnold Schwarzenegger's ear and said, we need funding for organic gardens in schools, and so schools have to be forced to spend this amount of money on organic gardens. So there were, you know, 80-something categories of funding, and nothing was fungible, and principals couldn't spend money on a teacher or on books because they had to grow baby carrots somewhere at their school sites. I think that's a little crazy. And most people in school finance research would say fewer categories are better, but we need some categories to ensure that people are spending money in ways that we need to. I think actually, if we did actually track and audit where funding was going within within school districts, and having that accountability in place would actually allow us not to have to over-rely on categorical funds to make up the difference accountability-wise.
I would agree. I mean, I think that's what I was going to say. With the, if you really just did a lump sum and it came to school, I think the issue now is, where would that money go? And there's really no way to understand that. And I think that having that tracking, because the tracking now is more about regulatory and compliance than it is about, you know, analysis and effectiveness. And I think if you had that part of it coming on the back end of it, you could go to a broader, you know, less worried about, you know, which category of funding is it coming in at. You could just do a broader piece of it with the accountability on the back end for where you're spending it. I think that'd be greatly effective.
On the last part of the question, what are the downsides? So the upside of the system we have, of, you know, the money's fragmented in all kinds of places, is that nobody's going to waste a lot of it, and nobody's going to steal a lot of it. If you put it all into one place, you can have some monumental waste and some big theft. And that actually, New Orleans, which has dramatically decentralized the control of funding, schools have serious control of funding and staffing and everything else. They've had a couple of cases of predictable people that, why did you give that person a charter, that stole the money and took off, you know, and you've also had some cases where people paid themselves very large amounts of money but actually were able after the fact to justify it and give it performance. But there will be, with transparency comes the chance of misuse and comes the even greater chance of embarrassment, and that's just the way it is.
And I'll add, and I think that we have some good examples of it, and we kind of live it here, and that from a charter perspective, the vast, vast majority of your funding comes in really in a, it's a per pupil thing that comes in, and you have to make decisions. You have to pay your, are you going to transport students or not out of that? You have to decide, I'm going to pay my rent out of this or not. I'm going to pay for the computers I buy out of this or not. So there really isn't, when you think of a traditional school funding formula where you have capital projects and transportation funds and debt service and all those things, you know, in a charter school, you really have. So the example's there. It works. I mean, people work within that and figure out ways to manage to that every year. So it works. I think, again, to the concern of it does, you could have some issues with that, and it would be nice. I would like it to have at a state level that kind of tracking mechanism on the back end. But it does work. I mean, we do have it now with just, you know, again, just general funding coming in, and it's up to the operator, to the school leader, to decide, you know, if I'm going to buy bus passes for everybody, that's less money for this. I have to make a decision around that, and that's, you know, that's a school level decision to make, and it largely works.
So I want to end this on a really bad negative note.
Good. Well, you should.
That, yeah, with the, on the side of the consequences of putting money in the lump sums, putting into school. So it opens the possibility for criminal behavior. And people who misuse the money should do the perp walk, and they should be prosecuted. And that would take care of it. Because it is just a business malfeasance. And we, even in New Orleans, there's been two, their hearts were in the right place. Throw them in jail. That would be the end of the misuse of the funds.
That's a bonus.
Yeah, I know.
Correctional policy,
so
too.
Law and order, bump, bump. You know?
Very good. Excellent. Well, on that note, I do want to thank our tremendous panel, Scott Best, Kariga Rausch, and Ashlyn Nelson. I think that deserves a round of applause.
And I also want to formally acknowledge Representative Mary Ann Sullivan, and we had City Council Member Leroy Robinson here, but I believe he left, which all more to the point that I should have acknowledged you early. Thank you for spending an evening with us. Appreciate that. And then last, but certainly not least, I do want to thank Paul Hill for being here. Paul, as you might have guessed, comes from Seattle, and it's not exactly easy to get from Seattle to Indianapolis. So Paul's probably still thinking it's Monday or something to that extent. But he has been tremendous. We've had him. I've been running him around all day long, and he's been tremendous every step of the way, and we greatly appreciate you being here.
I've had a tremendous time, and I've come up with a lot of ideas.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Paul Hill. And I also want to thank all of you. Tremendous questions tonight, as always, and thank you for being here. As Kariga said, beautiful Wednesday night. Hopefully you can get out and enjoy part of it still. So pay attention to our websites and Kelly tweeting and everything else about future events coming up. Like I said, we're going to take a look at how we did through the first four and then decide where we go from here. But again, thank you all for your support. Appreciate it.